And I don't think that it's fair or honest, completely honest, to say that it's not often used as a persuasion strategy. I would even say go as far as saying that it's an attack strategy, right? It's a good way to attack a badly held belief. And in that sense, I think it is persuasion. Even if it's not persuasion towards your belief, it's persuasion away from a badly held belief. 90% of the people who engage in it are engaged in it as a way to, like, induce questioning of other people's beliefs. Do you really hold that it's not a way to persuade away?
What we try to do in street epistemology is ask questions. I think at one point during the conversation, I think I asked him something like, well, how did you determine that this is true? To which point he said, well, it's faith. We worked out a definition, and then I asked him this question here. Can faith make people think other gods exist? So notice I didn't say, yeah, but everybody uses faith to conclude that their gods are real. When you phrase it as a question, and you give them plenty of time to think about it, you can see that he's pondering this question. You don't typically get this kind of response when you're yelling at somebody or pointing out things in their book that are going to probably make them defensive.
Is just believing or having faith in anything a reliable way to have confidence that something's true?
I think faith.
Why?
Because it's... You're good at this.
I'm just very interested in why people believe.
It's asking me tough questions. I didn't even learn this in Bible class. Or I slept through it.
Hi, this is Daniel Ray, staff apologist with Watchman Fellowship and host of Apologetics Profile. Welcome to part two of my discussion with senior apologist Brady Blevins on the topic of Peter Boghossian and street epistemology. On part two of our discussion, Brady and I talk more about what exactly street epistemology is and how we can give thoughtful response to those who engage with us. As we mentioned in part one, street epistemology began in 2013 with atheist and philosopher Peter Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. Today, it remains a widely popular conversational technique for atheists and skeptics to get Christians to doubt their faith. As we saw in part one, this is Anthony Magnabosco, a leading practitioner of street epistemology, giving a talk about street epistemology at the Black Nonbelievers Conference this past January. Here, Anthony describes that street epistemology began as an atheist movement.
This originally started as a hobby of mine. I read a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists because I was having horrible conversations with theists. I was arguing with them. I was damaging the relationships with the loved ones in my life. And I was looking for a better way. And this book came along. There's a second book now that's called How to Have Impossible Conversations. But the main concepts of it are to, again, trying to focus on what's really propping up the belief as opposed to attacking the belief itself. There are now thousands of people around the world having conversations where they're using this approach. Now, it did start off in atheism. I think we've kind of broached the skeptic community, I suppose. And my goal this year is to break it out even further. I want to try to mainstream this technique because I really think that there's something to this.
Anthony has had hundreds, if not thousands, of conversations with people on the street, on social media, using street epistemology. Anthony shares that engaging with so many people has actually humbled him and challenged him to examine his own beliefs.
When I first started going out, I was intent on having conversations with people about why they thought God was real. Because I'm an atheist, I don't think God is real, and I don't think people can justify it. And you can absolutely use this approach for that. But I've used it for all sorts of things. I've got some video clips here I'll show where we cover karma. I've covered the law of attraction. I don't have videos here. I've had about 1,000 conversations with people on a variety of different topics. The other thing, too, is this actually tends to change the practitioner. You tend to be a little bit more empathetic about the people that you disagree with. You can see that they're a human that's just walking around with a conclusion that they probably can't justify, and yet they haven't discovered that yet. They haven't realized that they can't justify it to their own standard. So if you can just engage with them in a conversation where you're using this approach, you're probably going to help them do it. And it humbles you. It humbles you about what claims you tend to make. I'm a lot more humble about what I state is actually the fact.
But when asked by Christians and other theists what they should do if they gave up their belief in God, Anthony refers them to the atheist and skeptic community.
What am I supposed to do if I don't believe that there's a God anymore? She's verbalizing her concerns, and I'll oftentimes repeat it back. And sometimes when people are talking, you get really excited about what you're hearing. And sometimes, I try not to do this, but I think in this example, I interrupt her because she says something really profound that I want to focus on. And I'm glad that I did, because it results in this wonderful reveal.
You know that this is true.
How do I know that? And that's the thing about it. I don't necessarily know that it's true. However, I know you have to believe in something higher than yourself. And that's what I was taught, and I choose to do. I choose to believe that this God, like you said, I could believe
choose
in a rock.
Choose to believe in the God.
Yeah, I can choose to believe in a rock as my higher power, as long as it'll help me get through the things that I need for it to get me through. And it's sort of like...
Are you just believing in the God because it's a coping mechanism to get through difficult times?
Yes.
When you have an open, honest conversation partner like that, and you use this approach of respectful questions, which with a lot of time to process and think it through, some amazing things can happen. And I'm so grateful that they took the time to have this conversation. It's like 30 minutes long, by the way. This is 20 seconds out of a 30-minute long conversation, but I hope you check these talks out. Very sincere, very open, very honest. Very honest. Both of these ladies were extremely honest. And at the end of it, it was, we enjoyed this so much. Thank you for having that talk with us. All right, let's talk about safety nets a little bit. This approach can be very upsetting to some people because you're probing beliefs that are core to a person's identity, especially the God beliefs. Not so much maybe the karma one or the umbrella in public, you know, opening up an umbrella inside a building. These conversations can really rattle people. You can send people into tailspins if they really start to think about their reasons and methods and they come to realize that they can't justify it to themselves, to their own standard. So when I go around and I speak about street epistemology, I try to impart the obligation that I think that we have to be responsible practitioners of the method. So at the end of that conversation, I gave them a card to reach out to me. And I always try to give people a way to reach out to me after these conversations, because maybe they want to meet again, or they want me to talk to their pastor or a spouse, or their mom, or their dad, or whatever. Or they want to meet again because they have better reasons and better methods. They're engaged. Or they're saying, you've really gotten me to start questioning here. What are my options? Which is why I love groups like Black Nonbelievers and Recovering from Religion and those groups.
Here Anthony makes an interesting point about how religious groups and professional believers are troubled by the tactics and methods of street epistemology.
I've even had religious groups, well, I don't know that for sure, but it seems like some groups on campus weren't really happy with me being out there, especially when members of their group were coming up to me talking and then really starting to question things, I think. I think that was a little bit threatening to some of the groups on campus. And then, of course, you have your professional believers, the apologists that are out there. They're not happy at all watching regular believers struggle to answer basic questions about why they think God is real.
But why should Christians take issue with street epistemology if it was just a method for civil conversation about people's beliefs? It is because of the covert intent of atheists and skeptics using street epistemology for the sole purpose of getting Christians to doubt their faith. On the one hand, street epistemology emphasizes cordial and civil dialogue, something we as Christians can certainly accept and agree with. But on the other hand, disguising one's intent to cause doubt within a friendly conversation is disingenuous. As we mentioned in our last broadcast, if you have children or grandchildren that are away at college, or if you or anyone you know is actively in social media sharing their faith, you are likely going to encounter someone practicing street epistemology. On part two, Brady and I will give you more insight into what street epistemology is, how you can recognize it, and we'll share with you some very practical and biblical tips for responding to those who engage you with street epistemology.
I am Brady Blevins, and welcome to another episode of Apologetics Profile. We are picking up where we left off in our last conversation, Daniel Ray and I, Watchman staff apologists and expert when it comes to SE and or street epistemology and being able to share our faith. So today, before I introduce Dan officially here, I will say this. We are going to get into what I think is going to be the most fascinating part of our conversation. And that's, what do you do when you engage a conversation with someone who is a street epistemologist? And there is nobody better that I can personally think of to have this conversation with than our very own staff apologist, Daniel Ray. Dan, good to have you back.
Nice to be here again. Glad to have this opportunity to share with everybody what I think is really important. If you have kids in college, or you yourself, or if you're active on Facebook and Twitter and the apologetics Christian debate, if you meet atheists online or whatever, mm-hmm. you're going to see this. And so it's important to know what it's all about.
Yeah. The second that you post anything of any spiritual value, nature, assertion, anything of that matter, you are very much open to engaging what we learned in our previous podcast, a street epistemologist. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this is important because, I mean, if you're like me, and I have my oldest is getting ready to head off to college here in now we're just in a matter of months. We're not even years away. We're months away. And of course, as a parent of a 17-year-old young man, this is something that piques my interest for him. But as I learned just a few weeks ago, and it wrapped up just a couple of days ago, street epistemologist and street epistemology is something I need to be concerned about as I just recently engaged somebody in this matter. So this is something that we are all going to deal with, whether it's directly, as in my case that I just experienced, or indirectly, in that maybe we have a son, a daughter, a grandson, a granddaughter, a niece, or a nephew who makes contact with somebody like this, and as a result, may go through a period of real spiritual struggle.
So, yeah, like, just believing in a God doesn't make it true, right?
Not unless you truly know.
Unless you truly know. How could we know?
I think it's just faith, going back to faith.
It's faith?
It's not, yeah. That's what I believe. Having faith.
Just believing in something give you knowledge mm-hmm. about it?
I think so.
If someone just believed in Santa, does that give them knowledge about Santa?
No, but you got to do, like, there's no evidence for Santa.
Is there evidence for a God?
Mm-hmm.
What's the best one?
There's a lot. Like I said, there's a lot. I have to think, but you're putting me on the spot. It's hard. I do. I have them written down, actually, in here.
Okay. If all that evidence, I'm not saying it's not true, that evidence, mm-hmm. but if all that evidence was found to be not reliable, would that change your confidence that the God is real?
No.
So it's not
it really wouldn't.
So it's not really about evidence either?
No, it's just about faith. I think.
And faith is just belief?
I think faith is different than belief.
How so?
I think faith, it's more of like an internal feeling, and belief is just like, I don't know how to explain it, but I have this feeling in me that I know God is real, and like, I can't explain it. Everyone has to go through it on their own, You can't force someone to become Christian. You can't force someone to become another religion. It's just a choice they make. And I'm not trying to force anybody or anyone. Anyone can make their own decision.
Yeah. People have the right to believe in whatever.
They have the right, yeah.
But can people choose to believe in something and make it true?
I don't think they can make it true. I think it is true, or it's not true. I don't think you can make it true.
Gotcha. And it's also an internal feeling for you as well?
What's that?
It's also an internal feeling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like...
Are feelings a reliable way to have confidence in a God like this?
I would say so. You're asking tough questions. You really are. You're doing good. I'm not saying it's reliable. It's not. But it's just what I believe personally, and I always will believe it. I just have a very strong faith towards it.
Is just believing or having faith in anything a reliable way to have confidence that something's true?
I think faith.
Why?
Because it's... You're good at this.
I'm just very interested in why people believe.
I need to get my book out. I have a book in here. Helps me out. I can't memorize all of it.
Well, we can maybe take a pause here and think about it. Maybe come back in a minute or so.
He's asking me tough questions. I know. Wait, what was the question that you were asking me?
Why should someone use faith to believe in anything?
Okay. I need to get my book out. Can I get my book out?
Sure.
It's my book. Helps me out. I'm doing a Bible study right now.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay. He's asking me tough questions. I didn't even learn this in Bible class. Or I slept through it.
So, Dan, I am so happy that we're able to stop and take this time to talk about this, because I really think this is important us to talk about, and most importantly, for people to be concerned about. So let's kick this thing off. And the last time we talked about what a street epistemology was, we talked about Peter Boghossian, Dr. Peter Boghossian, who really kind of... originated this using a Socratic method. And now if you missed part one, it might be good to go back and listen to part one before you finish this one, but because we really laid a good foundation there to understanding what this is all about and how all this works. But now I want to delve into what an actual conversation looks like. And Dan, I've been able to read many of your online conversations via Twitter with street epistemologists. I've even watched the videos that you've made talking about street epistemology. I've even watched the review videos that street epistemologists made of your videos, which, by the way, they were fabulous. And we do need to go back and talk about those videos before our time is up today. But before we go any further, let's just dig into this and let's get to the heart of the question. What is a conversation with a street epistemologist look like?
Well, that's an excellent question, and we're going to outline this. But first, as we said in the beginning of the other broadcast, it is essential to know why you believe what you believe. The success of a street epistemologist to get someone to doubt isn't so much that the street epistemologist is so crafty and wise and smart necessarily. We're all human beings and have faulty beliefs, but it takes advantage of a lot of Christians who haven't thought about certain philosophical questions or are uncertain about their own faith, or maybe on the fence or something. Or if you encounter a street epistemology and you're sort of weak in the faith, and I don't mean that to put anybody down, just it takes advantage of people that have a limited understanding of Christianity. As we conceded in the previous episode, that Peter Boghossian is somewhat right, that he runs into this colloquial use of faith as belief without evidence coming from Christians. I just believe. And that's not really the orthodox understanding of faith as we outlined in the beginning. So the main success in these conversations from SEers is taking advantage of Christians that are not grounded And that goes back into discipleship and teaching. Yeah. And, you know, that's where the church, I think in the last several decades, that's where we've been weak in training and equipping. And I think that's why apologetics is important. This renaissance in training and equipping young minds to understand the gospel. And that's important, because without that, you will fall into this SE trap and find yourself in a period of doubt. But I would say that the SE thing is the catalyst that makes you realize the insufficiency of your own knowledge about how you come to believe things. So in the one hand, I would applaud the SE conversationalist in getting people to think more deeply about their faith. I think there's some SE people that would applaud you for strengthening your faith. If you came back to them and said, hey, my faith is strengthened because you made me go back and look. And you went back to this guy and you said, thanks for helping me because my faith is now more solid. There are some SE practitioners that would probably like that. There are some that wouldn't, but it's a broad spectrum. But the conversational technique, I'm going to take a general example. There are other tactics and techniques that are utilized, but I'm going to go with a big one because this one comes up a lot. It's the one you encountered. It's the one I see a lot. It's the one that's asked a lot about believers. What is your confidence that your belief in God, once you've established God as the topic, what is your confidence level in your belief in God? And so this is the Mount Everest. This is the pinnacle, I think, the primary tactic. And so they want to get you, as I mentioned in the previous broadcast, they want to get you to give a number. Oh, I'm 100% confident God exists. And then sometimes they'll come back and define 100 as something, you know, epistemically impossible that no human being would attribute, you know. And so they define 100 in an impossible way. And then the Christian, or the theist, dials down his confidence to like 98. And I have a video of this where I break this down, where a guy says, I'm 100% confident Jesus exists. And then the SE person defines 100 in an impossible sort of no way, never question, never doubt, nothing, no way, no way, no way. And then the Christian goes, well, it's 98. And then right away, it's already in a downward position.
Yeah.
And then they'll proceed to ask you very specific questions. So, you know, I might say, well, I think the Bible is one reason, the main reason maybe I'm confident, as an example, of how God exists and how I know that my belief is true. And so what they'll do then is they're not going to question so much the Bible and the apologetics, reliability of the Gospels, manuscript evidence, all that kind of stuff. They'll just say, well, how do you know the Bible is true? And then they'll proceed to sort of dial down your confidence in the Bible. Well, do you know that there are other religions out there? I mean, I can't tell you, Brady, how many times I just go, that argument works with a lot of people, like Vishnu and Allah, and they bring these other gods up.
Yeah.
And people are like, you know, the street epistemologist says, you know, well, if the Hindu uses faith to believe in Vishnu and the Muslim uses faith to believe in Allah and you use faith to believe in Jesus, then maybe faith is the problem. And you're just like, no, but that's what they do. And so they think that faith is the problem because there's all these other religions out there and they throw these other religions at you. If you're having a conversation with one person like that online and they bring up Vishnu, you can rest. I don't know why they use Vishnu all the time, but that's a key God they bring up. And you can just say, well, you know, people use logic and reason to come to different conclusions. People use logic and reason to come to different conclusions. Why are you saying that by what you're saying here, that if faith is unreliable, then logic and reason would be unreliable too, because so many people use logic and reason to come to different conclusions. So maybe we shouldn't distrust, should distrust logic and reason. There's something wrong with their analogy. They try to isolate faith and make faith look like it's unique among all the other ways that we know things. And they try to reduce your confidence in the Bible by bringing up other religions. So you have to, not that you have to know comparative religious studies to be able to answer this question, but to be firm in your knowledge of Jesus, the resurrection and the reliability of the Gospels, and why they are unlike Islam or Hindu or Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormonism. That's where we help out a watchman. One of the ways that I end conversations with street epistemologists is that I tell them that I work at an organization that studies other world religions. And then pretty much that part of the conversation is over. because I'm ready to converse in whatever religion they want to talk about. Yeah. But that's one thing. And so they'll dial that confidence down. And so somebody goes, you know, I never thought about that before. Maybe I'm now I'm 70 on the Bible. I still believe it, but I'm 70. So they go, so then they'll go, well, okay, so what brings you to that 98% confidence? If we can set the Bible aside now, what else do you see? Well, I think the universe doesn't look like the universe could have just come into existence from nothing. And then they'll try to dial that one down, you know, and they'll go through a series of things. You might say, well, personal experience, conviction, blah, blah, blah. And they'll try to dial that one down. And so after they go through these four individual things or whatever you say, they've tried to wipe away your cumulative case. And they'll try to end the conversation by saying, well, so what gives you this 98% confidence level? Because, you know, I just knocked down all four of your things. And so why are you 98% confident? And they go, I'm not. I'm like 70 now. I'm like 80. I'm like 60 or whatever. And you can imagine the impact that this has on younger people who've not really been taught how to think through these things. And so that's the confidence scale. And that's what they use a lot.
I can't base a belief on faith. I wouldn't want, if I discovered I was basing any belief on faith, whether there was life on Mars or that there wasn't life on Mars or that I'm the cutest guy on this campus or whatever. If I discovered that I was using faith for anything, personally, my confidence would drop from the 100 to probably the 3%. Because I recognize that people are using that method to get to all different kind of beliefs, which is why I want to encourage you to maybe think about what instance could possibly ever exist where I can use faith and not conclude that it was true?
Use faith and not conclude that it's true?
Am I using, can a person, here's my easier question.
Okay.
Can a person use faith to conclude that anything is true? Don't even answer it now. But just run through scenarios through your head.
Okay.
Could I use faith to know that that's true? Yeah. Could I use faith to know that that's true? Yeah. Could I use faith to know that that's true? Yeah. What's an instance where you couldn't use faith to know that something was true? And if you find that, I can use faith to know that anything's true, I'd ask you to just kindly reevaluate the importance of faith in the accuracy of this belief.
You know, if it was just faith that kept me as a Christian, I mean, I would still be an atheist. You know, I would still be living that life.
Do you find faith as a good thing? Is that correct?
I do. It's personal things, the miracles I've personally seen in my life that have changed the way I look at things. And it's the belief that those miracles were done by God and Jesus has affected my life.
Do you know that those things happened because of faith?
Yes. Okay. Well, happened because of faith? Like,
do you believe that they happened because you're basing it on faith?
Yes, I think.
And so embedded in those questions that they ask you are counter-apologetic assumptions about the Bible, about the cosmos, about biology, about science, about personal experience. Embedded in all of their questions to you as they're trying to reduce your confidence are tacit counter-apologetic atheist counter-apologetics for those that are practicing the SE for the particular brand of atheism. But that's a very common on Facebook, Twitter, on YouTube. Those are the most popular discussions you'll see on YouTube. And then like I said, the interlocutor will say, well, then is faith really a reliable reason, a reliable method by which we come to know the truth of things? And so they've kind of scored a victory if they've gotten you to go from 98 to 70. That is a typical engagement with a street epistemologist.
You know, that's interesting in that, you know, you'd mentioned before that, you know, they're looking to just, if they can just knock you down a percentage, you know, even if it's just one point, they feel like that they have won the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But, and this is what I found interesting. Whenever in my most recent conversation with an atheist, and they were trying to use this SE tactic, one of the very first questions was this issue of confidence. And I mean, of course, obviously, I work here at Watchman Fellowship, and we're involved in this kind of stuff. And so the red flag immediately went up, and I knew what I was dealing with. But I stopped for just a moment just to kind of ponder the question and think, this is kind of a ridiculous question, because whatever number I would have responded with would have been a made up number. Mm-hmm. How do you quantify how much you believe something? It's a bad question. Mm-hmm. And so my response was, now I'm going to go ahead and put myself in the hot seat with you for a minute. My answer was that I was sufficiently confident the existence of God. So mm-hmm. How did I answer, Dan? Was that a good answer or a bad answer?
No, that's excellent. And if you say something like that, what you're going to get immediately, it's going to be revealed to you that you're talking to somebody who is a street epistemologist, because there are people who have various levels of experience. There's some that have been doing this for almost 10 years. And there are some that are just, they see YouTube channels, and they're like, oh, I can go out and do that. And they go out and do that, and they don't have the seasoned engagement.
Yeah, like, I can do that.
Yeah. A lot of these people who have the YouTube channels with thousands of subscribers have been doing this for years. Some of the more less experienced street epistemologists will just go out there. I've got a camera, I've got a computer, I can go out there and do this and ask these trick questions, whatever. Mm-hmm. You just say, well, I'm confident. That derails some of them. They don't know what to do. Some of them, the more mature, will progress past that. Oh, no, don't worry about it. Okay, so let's just talk about your level of confidence. But some of the other ones, the reason I think, Brady, from what I've seen and what I've engaged, what happens is you've established rapport with a total stranger. So you're in that awkward rapport bubble. Like you sit next to somebody on an airplane. You're like, oh, where are you going? What brings you to LA? And you have that conversation. You're like, I was a Lyft driver for a long time.
Yeah.
You start small talk. You kind of feel out, like, should I keep talking? Should I stop talking? You have this rapport bubble and you don't want to pop it, right? So as you're in this delicate rapport bubble with a total stranger, they've just asked you the initial question, which is, I agree with you, kind of odd. What is your confidence in your belief in God? And they want you to go along with this confidence scale. You don't want to break that rapport bubble, right? You want to kind of go along with it.
You don't want to be that guy.
You don't want to be that guy. It's make an awkward conversation all the way from Chicago to LA. You got to sit next to this person, and all of a sudden you're like critical of what they're doing. But you have to pause and ask, that's just a weird question for somebody that you just met. I mean, for people that do this on the campuses and on the parks and stuff, you walk up to a guy with cameras and a microphone and a clipboard. You need to step back and look at the whole situation and recognize something else is going on here. Why are you videotaping this? Why this question? This is like, now I'm in psych, and I feel like I'm in my therapist's office. You're asking me about my confidence level.
Mm-hmm.
And so confidence really has nothing to do with the belief. This is the magnitude impact of street epistemology. They are going after Christianity in a backdoor sort of way. Without dealing with the claims of Christianity, they just want to attack the person and what the person knows. It doesn't really deal with the arguments, but it is a tactic, a counter-apologetic tactic. So when they talk about confidence, you're off the map into the psychological realm. Why do you want to know about my confidence and my belief in God? What's that? So a lot of people go along with it, A, not knowing what's going on, and B, but once you commit to that, there are several other steps in the street epistemologist repertoire that are what I call structured or guided questions. And they're often true, false, yes, no, tangible, intangible. They're often, I've had this experience myself where I've offered a response. Well, what do you think about this? I say X, Y, and Z. Well, Ray, I don't understand this. Help me understand this. Here, what about these? I'll make these responses and you can pick one. I said, well, no, none of those are my words. Those are what you picked. That's what you picked. I've told you what I mean. And if you're online, there's nothing wrong. I do it all the time. If I don't know what someone said, I just go look it up really quickly. But it's kind of, I think for many, somewhat disingenuous to say that you're not familiar with what those terms are, but then turn around and give you multiple choice answers. So they will guide you yeah. into that realm of making you choose things. And so it's not really mm-hmm. a conversation when you start to get going into it. You step into a series of pre-guided questions. Some will say there is no script, but there is a script. You can go on streetepistemology.com and there's like a chart mm-hmm. of all the classic SE questions. And they're designed to lead the believer or anybody into a corner of doubt. And so they are scripted. And so watch how you answer and see if, and they'll always offer analogies that are not necessarily in accordance with reality. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, if the Bible didn't exist, would that reduce your confidence in God's existence? I'm like, you know, it's another weird question. Like, how can I even answer that question? You know, but somebody yeah. will go, well, sure, if the Bible didn't exist. And so suddenly it seems like you've reduced the person's confidence yeah. because of this really bad analogy, but it's not even anywhere near the truth. So there's
when in reality, if we didn't have the Bible, we'd still be able to know that there, I mean, we wouldn't know it's the God of the Bible, but we would certainly be able to recognize via his creation, Romans chapter 1, Psalm 19:1. You know, you kind of go down the list, but it's a nonsensical question because we're basing our personal knowledge of God based off God's word. I'm glad you brought this up because it is, we're kind of looking at the red flags. We see, you know, that first red flag of percentage wise, how confident are you in either your faith or whatever the case may be? Then giving you these options, because I ran into that same thing with my conversation that just recently ended, where the individual, they were just dead set on making an issue that was a non-issue for me. They mm-hmm. they wanted to force me into this area. And what was interesting is no less than a half a dozen times, I'm saying, this is not an issue for me. If you're really trying to rock my faith, this is not the road to go down. It just, you're picking an area that does not bother me. I could go either way on the particular subject that we were talking about, I don't see it affecting the truthfulness, or any of the truth claims of scripture. Mm-hmm. And this individual just could not handle. So what happens, Dan, when they're giving you like this A, B choice, but your answer is not A or B, your answer is C. What happens whenever you go and say, no, it's neither A nor B. My belief is this. What mm-hmm. happens in the conversation when that happens?
Well, for the less seasoned street epistemologist, they can start to get personal. And it's very tacit how they do it. You're mm-hmm. uncooperative. Well, you don't want to go along with this process.
Yeah.
And that's what happens a lot. That's what's happened to me. I have had engagements. This is an extreme example where someone has used my candid struggles with depression as a reason for why I don't want to challenge my beliefs. I'm afraid to challenge my beliefs. I'm afraid to go through the SE process because Jesus saved me from suicide and depression. Mm-hmm. But that individual is an extreme example, but that has nothing to do with anything. So they get personal. Some of them, the less experienced ones, will get personal quickly and make these suggestions. You're being uncooperative. You won't go along with the process. You must be afraid. Here come the ad hominems. They start subtly, like a small fire. And then some of them will just blow up into a rage that what Peter Boghossian uses the term doxastically closed. In other words, you're so closed-minded, but it's a pejorative that a Christian or a believer is intellectually doxastically closed. He won't listen to anything like fingers in the ear. And that's kind of a systemic fallback that a lot of less seasoned street epistemologists yeah. will say outrightly. But now the ones that are veteran, this is interesting about street epistemology. There are thousands of videos out there about street epistemology. So on the one hand, some of them want to present it as a civil way to have discourse. But on the other hand, you watch some of these videos and they're all public about atheists in back-channel street epistemology conversations talking about how do we get theists into the cul-de-sac of doubt? What are some trips and techniques that we can use to really get theists off their rocker and into the garage of doubt and unbelief? I mean, they're out there. So on the one hand, it is subtle out there when they're practicing it, but then on the street epistemology how-to videos, there's a lot of them where there's just atheists talking about how to rock a believer's world. So it's an unusual admixture, but even the veteran seasoned street epistemologists will behind closed doors sometimes say that Christian just has his fingers in his ears, or they make psychological evaluations, whether directly in front of a person or behind closed doors, about the person's psychological makeup.
Well, let's keep chatting with you more, but I understand you got your family here, so maybe some other time.
Thank you.
May I get your first name?
Oh, I'm Marianne.
Sorry. Marianne.
Yeah.
Marianne.
Yeah.
Marianne. Very nice. Thank you so much, guys. See ya. Unusual that she wanted to be interviewed and recorded with her kids standing by, so I'm going to have to add a blur to their faces. I really don't like getting kids in my videos. She couldn't wait to testify about her belief, even tripping over her words to get it out. And the way that she was staring at me when she made her claim, honestly, made me feel a little uneasy. For someone with a possibly seminary theology background, I was a little surprised that she would offer personal experience as her first reason for believing in a resurrected God. Oh, and did you notice when she asked me a clarifying question, I tried to model thoughtfulness and respect with my response? She started off as a close talker and she was rather tall, so I think the camera angle on this one might be a little funky at first. Now, I'll have to watch this again, but I think she held a confident superwoman's pose, you know, like with her hands on her hips, but then draped one of her arms across her abdomen and grabbed her other arm. Clearly, there wasn't enough time to probe her foundation of rock and examine her supposedly better justifications for believing in a God. Even though she said that she only had a minute, she turned around to engage with me some more, maybe because she felt like she didn't give a good justification at first, I'm not sure. The best thing about this talk in my mind was that in addition to her listening to these questions, her husband and sons were also standing by listening to them.
They're afraid. They're this, they're that. They don't like this. They don't like that. They don't like this. This guy uses depression as an excuse to say to the Twitter world that I'm afraid of examining my faith, even though I've told him repeatedly I do that for a living. This is my job. But, so it can get personal, or they can come back with in wanting to appear helpful. They can come back with more scripted suggestions. Well, why don't we try this instead? Or why they might try another analogy where they offer answers. But one thing that they're going to do repeatedly is continue to put the spotlight on you and keep it off of themselves. Some don't mind the questions and will engage you briefly about that and respond to you. But when you start asking questions about their epistemology, about their belief, if you find out they're an atheist, how do you street epistemology your atheism? That's not favorably received. And those kinds of questions can quickly end what started off to be a civil discussion because of the nature of the interlocutor. And if you're a discerning person and a relational person, you can discern what's going on. You get the feeling that this person's, if it was a guise, you quickly can feel like internally, it's not just a feeling, but a discernment that something is not right. And so as you get those feelings, as the personal, the personal comes up, that's when I would recommend as a believer, you can just say, thanks for your time. I appreciate it. I'm not comfortable talking about that. Let them think about why you answered that way. But if they start off with those tacit personal assumptions about you, it's not going to get better.
Yeah. It was interesting. Reading your Twitter feed is, I don't know how you do it. I would have gone crazy a long time ago. It amazes me though, the number of mental health professionals that just happen to be drawn to your Twitter feed. I mean, these people are giving these incredible psychological evaluations and, I can't believe that all those professionals just happen to come to your site. I'm being facetious, of course. It's one of the things that was just amazing to me, because you're not on the platform that I was on when I was having my conversation with this individual, And I shared my conversation with you. So you were able to read what was going on. And it amazed me. I'm like, I was going to call you Dan Stradamus or something. I don't know. Because you were predicting what this other person was going to say after every reply. You said, well, now they're going to say this, or, hey, get ready, because the next thing that's going to happen is going to be a personal attack. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened. Whenever I took this person and reversed it and put them in the hot seat and actually asked them a really simple question. And the question was just very simple. Do you believe in, you know, that there's objective truth, or do you believe that truth is subjective? Which is a very simple question. I mean, it's, and I get back this long response. And then with just a little bit of pressing, man, the next thing you know, I'm dumb. I'm at one point academically dishonest. I mean, just all the name calling just kept coming. Mm-hmm. And it's like, where did this come from? I never once insulted you. Mm-hmm. All I did was ask you questions and challenge your epistemology. And you're hitting the nuke button on me. Mm. And it's something that when you engage in these conversations, you know that you struck a nerve when you receive this kind of feedback. And so I guess what I want to ask here is that, is it really always that predictable?
Well, as I said in the last episode, every street epistemologist that I've ever seen is an atheist. This is an entirely atheist phenomenon. Not all atheists are street epistemologists, by the way. We know atheists at our book club, I think we would trust with our lives. Mm-hmm. We are friends with some of them.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And this would be a tactic, uh-huh, I think, for the skeptics that we know personally. This is, they don't do this. There's a lot of atheists that do, mm-hmm, see the tacticness of it. And it's not a genuine conversation for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, in the last episode about the ethics of street epistemology, a lot of people, skeptics, are going, is this ethical to take away, you know, okay, so you may not think Mormonism, mm-hmm, is true, but is it ethical to rip away a Mormon's, you're taking away everything if you're causing them to doubt, friends, family, church, everything, yeah, my whole entire meaning. What are you giving them in replacement? Is this ethical? I may not agree with Mormonism, but if that person's happy and adjusted, and should I mess with their minds? And so a lot of people are questioning the ethics of it. And so recognize that all atheists, as we know, are different in terms of their own psychological makeup. Don't in turn do a psychological, yes, evaluation on your interlocutor. We're not psychologists. Don't return the, yes, favor, because that just, and I've seen it, Christians do this. Well, you called me, you know, this, and, well, I'll call you that, and this and that. And that just, that's what happens in social media. And so don't return that.
Yeah.
But it is, for the, yeah, less seasoned, a quick draw, like, I'm out of bullets, I'm gonna throw my gun at you. And they've lost the ability, mm-hmm, to maintain, yeah, civility. Now, a couple of the top street epistemologists that have been practicing this for years know how to stay calm. They have techniques for how they stay calm when things get intense. And it's pretty good. And, you know, I would agree with a lot of the tips and techniques that they have. But you can be civil,
yeah,
and kind and sincere, mm-hmm, and still be an atheist. We're not questioning that. We're not, mm-hmm, doing psychological evaluations ourselves. But for the exit, as I told you, when it gets to that volume from their side, mm-hmm, that's just time to walk away. I mean, the conversation is not going to improve,
yeah,
once that starts to happen. But it's always there, Brady. No, it's always there. And in fact, at some of these conference street epistemology talks that I've watched, the presenter will talk about how there is a lot of psychology involved in street epistemology. So in some sense, mm-hmm, they are acting as miniature pseudo-professional, well, they're not professionals, but they are sort of doing, yeah, psychological evaluations on people's thought and cognition. Mm-hmm. And that's nothing to do with Christianity, and they're not trained or equipped to be doing that, but that's what they do. And so the minute you start to, yeah, feel like you're, I mean, the confidence thing is right, it's the foot in the door of psychology, getting into your mind and asking you questions about how you come to believe, questions that philosophers are still wrestling with. I'm reading a professional philosopher book on philosophy right now.
Exactly.
And epistemology is a huge thing. And there's still camps of people discussing what's the proper epistemology. So really, you know, the minute you sense it getting personal, don't carry it out. Just say, thank you very much. Have a nice day. But that, that does seem to be at the basement of where they are now. Again, it's not to judge their motives or to do psychological evaluations in return, just recognizing when that happens, as it's happening, you can either ask, well, why are you concerned about this part of my being? Why do you want to know this? Or, you know, just ask some questions, which we can talk about here about how to respond.
Yeah. And I think it's important, and I just want to make sure that our listeners know this, that if you're engaging online in social media, it's okay to let them have the last word. Let them have it. And in fact, sometimes in some of my conversations, I've said, you know, it looks like this conversation has gone as far as it can go. Or sometimes I've even said, it really seems like we're no longer productive. Maybe we're talking past each other. I'm going to go ahead and let you have the last word, and you can say whatever you need to say, and we'll just let this conversation die a natural death. And here's the important thing. Once you say that, you got to stick to it. Let them have the last word, even if they call your mama ugly or, you know, whatever the case is, just let it go.
Yep.
Realize that you have said something. You have put that rock in their shoe, which, by the way, is a term that is a slogan they use, as well as Kokel in his book Tactics uses. Yep. Put a rock in their shoe. You've bothered them. Hope we just got to pray that the Holy Spirit will take that and use it and convict them, and that they will heed to the leading of the Holy Spirit and listen. If they do, great. If not, that has no reflection on you or how you shared the gospel or anything of that nature. All right. Well, we're actually coming really close to the end of our time. So look, but we've got to tackle this question. I know we've already kind of started hinting in on it, but specifically how to respond to a street epistemologist. So Dan, if you could kind of give us an overview of the best way for us to respond when we do encounter a street epistemologist,
well,
AKA an interventionist.
Yeah. Well, you know why you believe what you believe. Know the reasons for why you believe. They might find them silly or irrelevant or unjustifiable. They will come at you with, how do you justify that? How do you test that? That's okay. You can give them personal experience. You can say, I find whatever it is that ultimately how you came to believe, share that. And be confident in your knowledge of who Christ is. Be confident in your knowledge of Scripture, and know why you believe what you believe. That is paramount. That is foundationally important, to know the Scriptures, to study, to show thyself approved unto God. That's primarily the thing to do. And then the second thing, where I need work, we all have different temperaments and personalities. I watched a street epistemologist talk to a wonderful, sweet, collegiate young lady who was so sweet. I love Jesus. Here's why I love Jesus. I know I love Jesus. I know he loves me. How can I pray for you? This and that. Just, you know, she obviously hadn't thought of a few questions that he had asked her, but she was genuine to the end. And you just wanted to, like, oh man, what a sweet woman. You know, each of us is going to respond differently. Some people are just going to be very proactive and gospel centered and all that stuff. And some people are going to be more introverted. And so don't respond outside of the skin of your own personality. Don't try to be a philosopher if you're not. Do what God has equipped you to do. And don't get frustrated that you have to reply like this wonderful girl did. Just give a defense for the hope that is in you. And that's different for everybody. You know, how do you know Jesus is true? And do that. Mm-hmm. And so that is where it's a good thing about street epistemology. Be confident in what you believe. That's primarily the thing. Be confident, be humble, and don't return their personal responses to them. Don't psychologically evaluate them. One specific example that came up recently that I can share and we can wrap up here is one individual had questioned somebody's reliance and confidence in the Bible. And he said, well, you know, 12 apostles, 12 people it's we need more evidence than just the testimony of 12 people. Now, if you just think it's just a common sense thing, you can say, well, now, hold on a second. Why would one person's testimony about 12 people's testimony be more reliable than the 12 people he's putting down? I mean, these are the kinds.
That's good, Dan.
These are the kinds of things that you just need to stop, take a breather, and go, wait a minute. There's a common sense objection to most every one of their questions that they pose to you in an attempt to reduce your confidence. And so when they accuse you of God of the gaps, well, I think the universe looks designed. Well, we haven't really figured out, you know, where the universe came from or what we know. It seems like you're saying that because we don't know, therefore God. And I said, well, no, not at all, because I can say, why is this cup of coffee on my table? And I can explain it in terms of the mechanics of a coffee maker or something like that. And that's a perfectly reasonable explanation. Mm-hmm. But I can also say that, you know, I poured it.
Yeah.
The reason it's on the table, there's a mechanical explanation for boiling water and the biology of beans, but there's also the personal explanation. It's not God of the gaps. It's evidence of a mind.
Yeah.
You know, what do we count as evidence of a mind? The efficacy of mathematics, language, consciousness. And I'm not God of the gapping it. I'm saying that, you know, science might have a technical explanation, but a personal explanation is perfectly abductively reasonable. Inference to the best conclusion. Just a simple example. A mannequin has a hand, and we don't have any problem saying a mannequin is designed. But what about this human hand? What about the hand that actually does stuff? Well, I'm going to infer, unless shown otherwise, that this hand was designed just like a mannequin's hand was designed, or software, whatever. We see design in the universe like we see design in our own world, an inference to the best explanation. So just take a breath, pray, and look for common sense objections to what they're offering, because you're in a 5-minute conversation, you're on Twitter or social media, it's going to be the best thought of what an atheist has in his repertoire. And so just take a step back and go, you know, if somebody objects to the Gospels being written decades after the events they included, and you say, well, you know, the Gospels were written 40 to 70 years after the events they record, you can say, well, you know, your objection seems to be 2,000 years removed from the events recorded in the Gospels. Why would your objection millennia later be more accurate than those who were closer to the time of the events in question?
Yeah.
I mean, they're just, it's just common sense things like that. So you just ask God to help you with those common sense arguments, recognize them, and return them with civility and meekness and gentleness. And, you know, even though the conversations will get difficult and intense, they will. And so you have to be prepared for that, because in the end, underlying all of that is skepticism, atheism, and a contempt for God and his word.
I appreciate you sharing that, because listen, civility, not giving in to that temptation to respond sinfully, and most importantly, knowing what you believe. And that's a big part of why Watchman Fellowship is in existence. We're a discernment ministry. We want to help you to be able to think through these things. And before you can ever spot a counterfeit, in fact, to be able to spot a counterfeit, you got to know what the genuine looks like. And so that is chief amongst what we do here at Watchman, is beginning to know what that looks like. And so I appreciate you sharing that, Dan. And listen, this is great. We actually got a profile on this that's coming out in 2021, and so we'll look forward to what the Lord does moving forward, and use this tool. If you got to go back and re-listen to some of Dan's explanations for our listeners and even viewers on this one, this is a great opportunity for you to be able to defend your faith and be ready, or maybe help a loved one be ready and equipped for when they come into a conversation with somebody whose main goal is just to leave them with some doubt and in their mind. And listen, if you've been there and you've suffered through a season out, trust me, listen, every Christian has suffered through a season of doubt. And if they say they haven't, they're either not being honest or they just haven't thought about it, because doubt is one of Satan's favorite tools to use. And when doubt comes, it's not always a bad thing, because it's through my seasons of doubt that have helped me to dig deeper into areas that I would have never looked at before, but it's because of those questions, those nagging questions, that we can dig deeper into the faith and get to know and have a much better relationship with our Lord and Savior. And for that, I am grateful, but we need to be there for those who we love, and we need to be equipped ourselves to be able to handle those folks who come. Mm-hmm. So, Dan, we're out of time. Is there anything you kind of want to say in conclusion?
Yes. This is a great time to, as the Apostle Paul says in one of the Corinthian chapters, test yourselves. And this is a great way to do it. Now, don't be morbidly introspective. Even in all my 28 years of Christianity, which is a lot of it's been morbidly introspective, you know, accept the basic truths of who God says you are. And you can't doubt without a standard of truth, and don't trust your feelings. And there are questions you're going to get, questions I get, questions you get that we can't answer because we don't know everything. And it's okay if you, it's a little weird because if you're on camera or on social media, you feel the pressure to perform, right? It's harder to admit you're wrong or I don't know on a social media exchange or when you've got a camera in your face.
Gotta give an answer.
Gotta give an answer. And so you'll feel that pressure. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to say you don't know, but that because you don't know, it shouldn't knock your confidence. It's just something that you haven't encountered before. But it doesn't, it's not a defeater for Christianity. None of these questions that are being thrown at you are new. They're not new to God, and they're not new to the realm of the atheist Christian dialogue. There's nothing novel about what they're doing. And so rest assured in the confidence that the strongholds that come against you ultimately from the enemy and the adversary have been dealt with. They're defeated. They may not be things that you've encountered before, but take the opportunity to study, to show yourself approved, and to do so with gentleness and reverence.
Dan, thank you so much for this conversation today, and I appreciate your time. And just thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Brady. I was glad to do it.
And to our listeners, I want to thank you for the time that you've spent listening to Apologetics Profile. And it means so much to us. You don't know what it does for us to know that you're listening and the responses that we get. Just want to take a moment and say thank you and let you know Watchman Fellowship's here for you. You can contact us via email at the through the office. Right now it's kind of tough going through the office with the pandemic, but you reach out to us and we're here for you, and we want to help you through any evangelistic interaction, any kind of questions that you might have concerning the faith or other religions, cults, the occult, New Age spirituality. And of course, if you're so inclined, we'd love to be able to speak at your church sometime and do some on-site equipping. Yeah. So on behalf of Watchman Fellowship, I am Brady Blevins. You've been listening to my co-laborer, Daniel Ray, and you have been listening to Apologetics Profile. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you back next week. Goodbye.
This episode of Apologetics Profile has been a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on this and any of our other podcast episodes or resources, visit watchman.org today.